I would now like to introduce today's moderator, Mike Myers, HICE CEO.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending today's session. It's my pleasure to introduce our panel. This morning we have Bill Barcelona. Bill serves as the Executive Vice President for Government Affairs for the American Physician Groups, a national professional association of over 300 medical groups and independent practice associations across the United States. Our next panelist is
Nick Luizos.
Nick joined the California Association of Health Plans as a legislative advocate in May of 2006 and represents the association of its members' plans in the California legislature as the Vice President of Legislative Affairs. Also joining us this morning is Trina Gonzalez. Trina Gonzalez currently serves as Vice President of Policy at the California Association of Hospital Association, where she is responsible for developing CHA's policy positions on a wide range of legislative and regulatory issues that affect California hospitals. With that, I'll turn it over to our panel for this morning's session. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everyone. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our panel discussion today. And thank you, Bill and Nick, as always, for this panel discussion. I'll be kind of starting us off with some broad overview issues that we wanted to kind of talk about in today's presentation. So first is, as you know, this is like a kind of a legislative and executive kind of debrief, you know, what happened in 2021 and what we are facing and going to be facing in 2022. First thing is we wanted to cover some legislative themes. And here you see some kind of four big categories of themes that were part of our both our legislative and executive kind of activities in 2021. First was a significant investment and significant issue, a significant movement on issues around homelessness and housing. Everything from over $5 billion in various program investments on homelessness, including $1 billion per year over the next 5 years for cities, counties, and continuums of care that support homeless individuals, to $2.7 billion for Project HomeKey, which is, as you all may recall, is the one-time funding for street-based homelessness and innovative approaches for addressing homelessness. And during the early part of the pandemic, this was widely used by many cities and counties. To $10 billion in support for supportive housing and affordable housing units. COVID, obviously, is something that the legislature and the executive branch dealt with throughout the year and will likely be dealing with through 2022. Significant pieces of legislation included, for example, SB 510, which defined what a screening and diagnostic tests are in terms of whether it's COVID or future diseases. To requiring hospitals to develop health equity plans, AB 1204, which we'll talk about a little later. In addition, there were numerous executive branch activities related to related to COVID, whether that was flexibilities that the state has provided to hospitals and providers, all the way out to waivers for various activities in healthcare and otherwise. Energy was another space where the legislative branch, where there was much legislation that was passed and signed by the governor. Various initiatives, including initiatives to reduce air pollution, funding for technology investments, including more electric charging stations statewide, and grid modernization throughout the state, which is also very critical, particularly to many of our providers. Lastly, there was a lot of activity around the health equity and reducing disparities categories of work. This includes legislation from requiring hospitals to develop health equity plans or executive branch initiatives. We've all been hearing for years about CalAIM, and now we're about to enter into a new era of in Medi-Cal starting in 2022. And DMHC, for example, also has new funding to develop a health equity and quality committee, of which I'm sure many of you are keeping tabs of. The last thing I will mention on health equity and health disparities is that the Health and Human Services Agency is actually recruiting now for a chief health equity officer. So we expect in 2022, this will be a continued focus by the administration. Next slide, Bill.
Okay, thanks, Trina. I'm going to talk about the progress of the 2021 legislative session. Again, we started out with 2,700 bills in the session, 1,100 were passed, and over 1,000 were signed into law. Well, of course, we're focused on tracking health bills, and we are tracking roughly a little bit over 100 health bills this year. 83 passed the legislature, and then they go to the governor's office for a 30-day review period, and 67 were signed. This is my 16th year reporting out to you at ICE on this annual legislative session. And again, as I've indicated in previous years, the legislature continues to produce between 60 and 70 healthcare bills that get signed into law like clockwork. That is the production of the legislature in terms of health policy. So we are going to focus on the key bills that we believe affect all of you out there today, and we will move to the next slide.
AB 1130, what we all affectionately call OCA, or the Office of Healthcare Affordability Bill. This bill, well, initially part of the governor's budget, AB 1130 sought to create a healthcare cost control entity, the Office of Healthcare Affordability. In its draft form, it seeks to collect state healthcare expenditure data from hospitals, health plans, and others. It was moved to be a two-year bill, and you know, we definitely certainly expect it to be back in 2022 because affordability and cost issues continue to be something that both the administration as well as legislature would like to work on. While the bill did not pass, it is important to note that some of the funding to support the future office did pass as part of the governor's budget. So, for example, there was a fairly large increase, primarily for personnel, for the new healthcare information and quality analysis team or division within the Department of Healthcare Analysis and Information, HCI, formerly known as OSHPED. And so this part of the bill, of this part of the office, was passed as part of the governor's budget. So again, part of their work is going to be working on the finalizing the HPD. But we fully expect that this bill will be back in play in 2022, and all of us on the phone will, and all of us on this video will be definitely keeping tabs on 1130. Next slide.
And Patty, would you go to the next slide, please? Okay. Trina alluded to this bill, the AB 133 Omnibus Budget Trailer Bill. This created a number of things. We're going to talk about a few of them here today. First of all, it created the DMHC Health Equity and Quality Committee, which is scheduled to run from March through September of 2022. This committee will be appointed by Mary Watanabe at the Department of Managed Healthcare and run by the Managed Healthcare Department. It will create a state-run performance and equity measurement system, similar to what some of you have been involved in with IHA over the past 15 years. But this is a codified version. It will set state-mandated performance metrics that include both quality measures and equity measures. We're hoping that it will include a common core set of measures across all three major lines of business, Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial, to make it easier for providers and plans to perform to. But this new system, unlike the IHA model, which has been voluntary all these years, will be mandatory, and it will include negative consequences performance on a progressive enforcement scale, such as starting out with corrective action plans and moving all the way up to penalties, monetary penalties. The go live date for this new system is January 1st, 2023. We see this as a codification of kind of the longstanding IHA, P4P, and AMP models. Next slide. The AB 133 budget trailer bill also created the Office of Medicare Innovation and Implementation. And although this is pushed out a little bit further to a 2026 deadline, it is also very, very important for a lot of you out in the audience today, because this is the effort to coordinate with CMS and California for the integration of service delivery around Medicare and Medicaid. So where we've seen the duals demonstration existing for the past few years in six counties, this expands a full transition to a managed care system for dual eligibles across all counties in California by 2026. Now, it's going to be a phased-in participation effort. Counties that have already created their D-SNP models through their managed care plans will go first, and then counties that are still in the process of forming D-SNPs will go last, but everybody has to be in by 2026. This is an effort that's going on nationwide as well. For example, APG has been doing some joint lobbying with Levitt Partners in Washington, D.C., before CMS on how the payment streams between Medicare and Medicaid can be better integrated for dual eligibles. We think this is going to be a major effort for the state. It has a lot of ramifications for our members at APG, for example, and there are active stakeholder meetings going on at DHCS currently. Next slide. This is yours, Trina.
And the last thing that we wanted to touch upon around the budget bill is the language around health information exchange. AB1, as all of you know, at the beginning of the year, the governor had a brief proposal in his January budget, which attempted to outline a placeholder for health information exchange. Subsequently, two pieces of legislation were introduced, both one in the Assembly and one in the Senate, looking to advance the discussion around health information exchange. Where the legislature and the administration eventually landed was budget language to create what they're calling a data exchange framework. And this framework this budget language looks to do two things. One, it deems the Health and Human Services Agency as the lead entity to implement the data sharing framework. Two, it requires the agency to convene a stakeholder advisory group made up of certain entities, including hospitals, health plans, provider groups, and others. And it also puts in requirements for providers, payers, and others to comply with a data sharing agreement by certain dates, depending on size, primarily of the organization. The advisory group has been convened. It started its meetings in late August. The advisory group has also created a subcommittee of technical and legal experts to start to develop the data sharing agreement. For those of you interested in watching and keeping tabs on what is happening on the data exchange framework conversations, these are all public meetings, and they're meeting monthly, both on the advisory group as well as the data sharing agreement subcommittee. So this will continue into 2022, and it's something that everyone will be anxiously watching as this advisory group, the data sharing agreement subcommittee, as well as finally the administration's final report to the legislature in April of 2022. Next slide, please.
All right. Good morning, everybody. This is Nick Luizos with the California Association of Health Plans. I'll be taking a starring role on the next several slides. just by way of background, legislative year 2020, there was a limit on the amount of legislation legislators could advance due to the pandemic and restrictions to public access. Those limitations did not apply in 2021. So there's a lot of bills that moved. It was an onslaught of legislation. I will try my best to get through the bills that were enacted into law relating to health coverage. Starting with AB 347, which was introduced by Assemblymember Arambula, sponsored by the Arthritis Foundation, California Rheumatology Alliance, and the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. It's a bill that enacts a step therapy exception request process for prescription drugs. It was supported by a number of advocacy groups, including the pharmaceutical industry. The author stated the purpose of the bill was to try to reduce the number of denials for enrollees with respect to their prescription drugs. This is one of several attempts to modify utilization management. This is probably the least offensive bill that we've seen in a while, from our perspective at least. And so we took an oppose unless amended position on the bill for a number of reasons, including a really onerous reporting requirement on health plans and structure the process in a way that we thought would emphasize, expensive brand name drugs over generics. DMHC took an oppose unless amended position as well for its own reasons. Long story short, the bill was modified in a way that we were able to remove our opposition. I mean, key amendments were, the removal of a reporting requirement on the part of plans that I think the medical groups would have found onerous as well. They also modified language and removed the requirement that a clinical peer would have to review any denial of a step therapy request. We thought that was wasn't consistent with the way the process works for other utilization management decisions. And there were other amendments, that improved the bill. I will just note a quick update on this one. Technically, the way the bill is drafted, we think it applies to both commercial and Medi-Cal plans, but this bill has to be viewed in light of the Medi-Cal RX carve-out that's currently in process at the Department of Healthcare Services. We asked, CAP asked the department yesterday in a meeting whether this would apply to Medi-Cal managed care plans. And since the utilization management component of the drug benefit in Medi-Cal is being handled by a third party as a part of the carve-out, the department's basically said that from a practical perspective, this is a bill that, Medi-Cal managed care plans, will not have to implement from a practical perspective. So there'll probably be more questions on that that we'll have to sort out as well. But that is AB 347. And I think I covered both slides on this bill and happy to take questions at the end. We can move on to the next bill. AB 570, real quick on this one. This is a bill that, CAP didn't take a position on this bill. Essentially what it does, it requires coverage of adult dependents in California. From a coverage perspective and expanding coverage, this is one that, didn't really, create very many issues for our health plans. However, when we saw the independent analysis of the premium impact of this bill, it kind of raised some eyebrows, particularly on the side of employer purchases of healthcare. The chamber and a number of local chambers of commerce came out in opposition to this bill. It was eventually amended to remove the group market. So this is a coverage requirement that only applies to the individual market, and much of the opposition to this bill vanished after that amendment was taken into taken to the bill. So I think we can move on to the next bill. SB 221, this is a pretty complicated bill for CAP. This is a bill that was introduced by Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco. It was sponsored by the National Union of Healthcare Workers. Basically, what the bill does, it partially codifies the timely access regulations adopted by the Department of Healthcare, Department of Managed Healthcare, I should say, DMHC. In addition, what the bill does, it requires health plans to ensure that non-urgent appointments with a non-physician mental health care or substance use disorder provider, is effectuated within 10 business days of the request for an appointment. We oppose this measure in the legislature for a variety of operational and implementation reasons, including the fact that there's pretty documented, well-documented workforce issue with respect to mental health providers in the state of California. And, you know, that was one of the basis for us, you know, taking that position. You know, as the bill kind of gained steam in the legislature, the author did agree to a delayed effective date to this bill, which was pretty popular, quite frankly, in the legislature. And so with that amendment, you know, we, you know, decided to remove our opposition to this bill. But it will go into effect mid-years, is not effective January 1st, 2021. Okay, next bill. 242. We could spend a whole hour on this one. It was part of a two-bill package, although they weren't, you know, technically related per se. You know, there's been an effort since the beginning of the pandemic on the part of the provider community to basically require health plans to financially support, you know, the provider community during the pandemic. The argument being that the, you know, during 2020, particularly during the early quarters of the year, there was less volume, less claims and things of that nature. And so, you know, doctor's offices were suffering as a result. That was the argument. Of course, there was a lot of federal support, a lot of capitated payments still going out and the like, and voluntary offers of support on the part of the plans to the provider community as well. Very expensive proposals. SB 242 really focused in on PPE and business expenses as opposed to an assembly bill, which was held in appropriations and did not pass, which was broader in scope. So this one was tighter in terms of its mandate. You know, we were strongly opposed to this bill for a variety of reasons. You know, as the bill progressed, we, you know, had several conversations with the senator and the Assembly Health Committee when it landed in the Assembly. You know, some key amendments were taken in to the bill. The mandate's more focused on PPE as to other business expenses. You know, for example, the bill early on required IT reimbursements and other reimbursements that we thought were unacceptable from our perspective. So it's really more focused on PPE and those types of business expenses. And a key amendment that took place in the Assembly Health Committee was that the bill applies to public health emergencies that are declared on or after January 1st, 2022. So, you know, that the basis for that amendment as declared in the Assembly Health Committee analysis was that, you know, it applied to future pandemics and not the current one. So, you know, we were able to basically kind of reduce our opposition to this bill. And it was signed into law. Next bill.
Okay.
Yep.
I think that's mine.
Oh, that is yours.
Yeah, AB 457, Telehealth Provider Act.
I didn't mean to take the limelight away, man.
I'll give it right back. All right. So this establishes the Protection of Patient Choice and Telehealth Provider Act and the Telehealth Patient Bill of Rights. This applies to all regulated health plans and health insurers overseen by both agencies, DMHC and CDI. It requires health plans to notify patients of alternative network provider options other than their owned and or affiliated third-party telehealth companies. It requires health plans, a health plan telehealth provider to furnish the medical record to the enrollee's treating provider after the service has been provided, and it exempts Medi-Cal for now, but requires DHCS to consider applying these standards to Medi-Cal. All right, I think the next one is yours, Nick. Yes.
Right, thanks, Bill. I think just real quick on this one, when we first implemented the Affordable Care Act in California, a very important component to those implementation laws in California was that the coverage reforms be tied back to the federal, you know, individual mandate. You know, basically, you know, the ACA stood on, three legs of a stool, market reform, subsidies, and broad-based coverage, aka the individual mandate. And so with the state implementing its own coverage mandate and that mandate being threatened at the federal level, but California really backfilling that, and then increased federal subsidies, many of the advocates thought these tieback provisions were not necessary anymore. And so that was the purpose of SB 326, was to basically eliminate that tieback. SB 368, I think this is one of those bills that I think is going to be somewhat complicated. This was authored by Senator Limon from the Santa Barbara area, sponsored by Health Access of California. The effort here behind this bill was to require plans to basically keep better track of out-of-pocket costs incurred by enrollees and to make that information more proactively available to enrollees throughout the year so that they know where they're at with their deductibles and their out-of-pocket costs and out-of-pocket limits. We initially came out with an oppose unless amended position on this bill. We certainly don't oppose the ability of an enrollee to have as much information as possible as they can about, where they're at with their coverage. Our questions about this bill were more around on the operational side. Additionally, there are federal efforts to make this happen. And so part of our, request to the author was to try to align from a timing perspective, any state efforts with, federal regulatory efforts along these lines as well. We also wanted to be able to transmit this information electronically as opposed to snail mail. And so there were a number of amendments taken to the bill, that allowed us to basically back off the bill. It's not perfect. I think the timing is still going to be an issue. We wanted perfect alignment with the federal process, and the most we could get was a six-month delay to the bill. So, as this bill rolls out, we'll probably hear some questions from the plans and perhaps, the medical groups. But that is the story on SB 368.
Nick, do you think we're going to see a DMHC regulation on this?
We could. We haven't heard anything from the department, although I should probably check in with my legal and regulatory affairs person before I state that definitively. There was no signing message attached to this bill like there were on a couple others. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next slide. All right. This one's mine. So the SB 380 bill on modifies the end-of-life law. This amends the existing law on end-of-life care under the Health and Safety Code. It allows an individual to qualify for aid in dying medication by now making two oral requests at a minimum of 48 hours apart. It eliminates the prior requirement that a patient attest in writing. More than half of the cases where patients were considering aid in dying medication as an alternative, it was being administered too late for them to actually take advantage of this law. So this creates a different model for the Compassionate Choices effort. And it also extends the End of Life Act now out to January 1, 2031, because it was sunsetting. Okay, next one. And that's mine again. SB 428, Adverse Child Experience Coverage, requires coverage for adverse child experience screenings. So this is something that's been going on in Medi-Cal for the past 2 years. There's been quite an effort under the new administration to expand these, and now it applies to both Knox-Keene and Department of Insurance, HMO and PPO plans across the commercial and Medi-Cal managed care markets. It becomes effective this coming January of 2022, and it authorizes both departments to use a non-APA guidance model rather than a regulatory model for its implementation and coverage mandate. Next slide. And why don't you take this one at the beginning, Nick?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. And so I'm going to say at the outset that you know, CAP is challenging certain aspects of this bill in court. So I need to take that into account as I comment on this bill, and I'll get to that you know, in a sec. But basically, this is the bill that mandates that health plans cover COVID testing and vaccinations, you know, in a certain way. Obviously, we have no objection to covering testing and vaccinations. In fact, health plans have been covering testing since the beginning of the pandemic without share of cost in the vast majority of cases. That is part of our role. It's a role we accept, and you know, we're proud of the work that we're doing. The issue with SB 510 is that it runs counter to the guidance that we've been following from the state and from the federal government over the last year and a half or so. And you know, the main point of contention that is that it moves beyond medically necessary testing and into what we view as kind of surveillance testing, particularly at the employment level. And we don't think, you know, a proper review of the costs associated with that has been done. And in any case, takes us out of our traditional role of covering medically necessary services and wading into other areas. There are other provisions of the bill that relate to contracts between, you know, the health plans and the providers. You know, from a policy perspective, you know, we don't object. While we had objections to the bill in the legislature, you know, it was signed into the law. So, you know, we don't object to the application of the law from its effective date moving forward. However, the law is also retroactive back to March 2020. And so we are objecting to that aspect of the law because it applies retroactively and changes the rules and payment obligations related to COVID-19 tests that, you know, occurred obviously, you know, well over a year ago. So, you know, we don't think that's right. We don't think it's correct from a constitutional standpoint as well. Having said that, the only other color commentary I'll give there is that, you know, initially this bill was an urgency bill, so it would have been effective right when the governor signed it. That requires a two-thirds vote in the legislature. The assembly did not grant a two-thirds vote in the legislature, so it was amended to remove the urgency. So the bill technically takes effect January 1st. However, as I said, we are challenging those retroactive aspects of the law. And I should probably just pass the mic over to Bill at this point.
Okay. So APG, we're active sponsors of the bill along with California Medical Association. This is an important issue to us because of the cost shifting that's occurred during the pandemic. You know, of course, we'll be jumping in on the other side of the litigation as it evolves. And so it's great, full employment for lawyers. I'm always a fan of that. It's important to apply this policy retroactively because there are fundamental issues around contracting that have occurred during the pandemic. The notion that a pandemic was anticipated in existing risk-bearing contracts out in the California delegated model industry is phony, to say the least. No one anticipated in the Knox-Keene contracting process to assume risk for pandemic level services prior to the onset of this. And so this is really a line in the sand, a do or die kind of a fight between my side of the industry and Nick's side of the industry. And it may even bleed over to Trina's side of the industry too. Unfortunately, when the urgency cause was deleted here at the end of session, what we're now seeing out there is a flood of full bill charge testing claims by testing providers. And of course, if we had had the urgency clause, we would have been able to apply the reasonable payment standard that was in the legislation, but of course now we can't do that. And so now costs will increase unnecessarily across the industry in this last portion is of the year as we move up to the January 1st implementation deadline. So this will be a fun one. We'll keep sparring on this as we move forward. And
that's all right, Bill. We're still friends.
That's right. We're still friends. We are.
But just on that note, though, the last point that you made, you know, this is one of those rare bills that the governor issued a signing statement on. And so the department, as a result of that signing statement, is tasked with trying to deal with and resolve the out-of-network cost issue associated with this bill. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of plays out as it moves forward.
And we should note that this bill applies across the commercial HMO PPO market as well as the Medi-Cal managed care market, but it does not apply to the Medicare Advantage market.
Yeah, real quick on this one. This is, one of the various bills that we see every year related to utilization management. This one deals with biomarker testing. Senator Lamone from Santa Barbara, again, is the author. It was supported by various advocacy groups, providers, and pharmaceutical companies. The stated intent on this one was to improve access to targeted therapies and testing for advanced cancer patients. And, you know, as always, you know, the supporters of these types of bill view prior authorization as kind of a barrier. We oppose the introduced version of this bill because it initially was so broad, it included coverage for biomarker testing that is not only experimental, but beyond the existing standard of care. And so actually the medical officers within the plans were particularly perturbed by the scope of this bill. You know, the bill was eventually amended to to allow prior authorization for non-FDA approved therapies, and the effective date was delayed until mid-2022. And so for those reasons, we were in the position to kind of back off of our opposition. I will say, I think the industry behind this type of testing is probably going to be back with a follow-up bill next year that's much broader and, from the information I have, has been seen in other states as well. So we will we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah. I guess who's in charge of this section?
That's me. So the next slide. As I mentioned earlier, one of the themes from the legislative session were numerous both legislative proposals as well as administration initiatives related to health equity, and this is one of the legislative proposals that the governor signed. AB 1204 is the Hospital Equity Reporting Bill, which is going to require, beginning in 2025, or 12 months after the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services develops their measures for their health equity measures, will require hospitals to develop a health equity report as well as an implementation plan on how they are going to reduce disparities within their four hospital walls. This is a bill that that CHA opposed, all of us on this phone and many other providers want to continue to work on reducing health disparities in California. Our position is we all need to be rowing in the same direction in order to reduce health disparities. And hospitals are only one key component of reducing health disparities in California. However, this bill did make it through the pipe, and the governor signed it as part of legislation. There's also a small part of AB 1204 which alters the definition of vulnerable communities with regards to how they are defined for nonprofit hospitals in their community benefit plan investments. So it does expand the definition of vulnerable communities with regards to community benefit plans. That includes a wider range of categories, including a further delineation of race and ethnic categories, homeless individuals, and those who live in various other vulnerable communities. So we will continue to kind of keep tabs on both the health equity reporting piece, which will require HCHI, formerly OSHPED, to convene an advisory group to inform what these potential measures could be that a hospital will need to report on and develop plans on, as well as the community benefits components, as for many of the new components, there aren't accepted or standardized data sets that hospitals could report on to date. So we'll be continuing to work with HCHI as they develop regulations and guidance related to AB 1204. The next slide, please. I'm sorry, go ahead.
How does this relate to the AB 133 effort at DMHC?
As far as I know, it does not. And so this is going to be specific to looking at ARC and other quality measures that are currently reported by hospitals to primarily federal entities. And so at this stage, there isn't right now a connection, but this is kind of going to be one of the kind of ongoing questions, I think, Bill, that we're going to have to keep with HCHI on to ensure that there is some consistency across these reporting requirements, particularly as it relates to health equity, which, again, since CMS on the quality side, CMS is developing equity measures. We want to make sure we're in alignment with that. But between the DMHC effort, the Covered California effort, and more than likely the Medi-Cal efforts moving forward, I think we need to ensure, I think we're all going to have to watch to ensure there's alignment there so that we are measuring across the healthcare delivery system. And again, we need to row in the right direction. So, but thanks for the question, Bill.
Thanks. Okay, I'll take this one. AB 1356, Reproductive Healthcare Services. This creates new crimes under the California Freedom of Access to Clinic Act. It's directed at right to life proponents who videotape, photograph, or record patients or providers entering or exiting into a facility that provides reproductive healthcare services. Makes disclosing or distributing those images misdemeanor penalties, and it updates and expands online privacy laws and peace officer training relative to anti-reproduction rights offenses. Next slide.
So this is back to me. This is AB 532. This is a bill by Dr. Jim Wood of the kind of Northern California area. This is a bill that CHA also opposed primarily because of the last component. So the first two components of this bill are noticing requirements that patients are given kind of written notice that includes the hospital's address, hospital's internet address, or excuse me, internet addresses on how to apply for Medi-Cal and other public coverages. It also requires that the hospitals provide as part of this notice to patients the website wherein wherein patients can find the list of quote unquote shoppable services that is a federal requirement that hospitals nationally are under. But the third component is probably what we found most challenging, which is requiring hospitals to provide an estimate to a patient of potential services. And as we know, this is, you know, this healthcare is complicated, and this requirement will create additional operational challenges moving forward. However, this bill did pass and was signed by the governor, so it is effective January 1st, 2022. Next slide, please. AB 1020 is the healthcare debt and fair billing law. This is actually a codification of current regulations in statute. Previous to this bill, this statutory authority and subsequent regulatory authority resided at the Licensing and Certification Division at the California Department of Public Health, which requires hospitals to have a charity policy for individuals with high medical costs who are uninsured, and provides parameters around debt ceiling by hospitals. This bill has shifted the responsibility from the Department of Public Health to HCI. It has increased the threshold, the federal poverty level threshold, to 400% of poverty level, previously 350% of poverty level, to be eligible for charity care or discount payment programs. But lastly, what it does is provide a framework for hospitals regarding selling debt, and that it can only be done under certain conditions and circumstances that are set forth within the statute. The one thing of note, however, it does not prohibit a hospital from selling debt to nonprofit organizations whose mission is to basically close debt for individuals. So it still allows that practice for these various nonprofits and foundations that are buying medical debt for people who have medical debt, who have bills from hospitals. So it does not prohibit that practice, and it still allows that practice to move forward. Next slide.
Okay. We're at 12 o'clock. We have 15 minutes left. I'm going to move through these next series of slides quickly. SB 48 requires a new annual cognitive health assessment for patients who are 65 years or older. This is similar to what you see under Medicare. Next slide. SB 226 is an interesting bill. It will create a parallel process for the determination of reprocurement of health plan services for Medi-Cal in Sacramento County. It alters the way the state has typically administered geographic managed care. And in this parallel process, Sacramento County will determine which plans should be allowed to contract to provide services, as well as the Department of Healthcare Services, who actually enters into those contracts. Next slides. Pharmacy slides, I think those are mine as well. Nope, they're not. SB 306 is yours, Nick.
I don't have a lot to say about this one. My colleague Jed Hampton was the primary on this. I will just say that authored by the chair of the Senate Health Committee, sponsored by various advocacy organizations. I mean, it requires plans to cover FDA-approved home test kits for STDs, including the laboratory costs of processing the kits and such. They have to be deemed medically necessary or appropriate and must be ordered directly from an in-network clinician or furnished through a standing order for patient use based on clinical guidelines. Initially, we had several concerns. I think in the final analysis of the bill, we technically, still remained opposed to this mandate due to the potential impact on premiums. And the bill passed, primarily on a party line vote. Finance was opposed to the bill, citing potential significant general fund impacts not accounted for in the budget, but the governor signed it nonetheless.
Next slide. SB 310, unused cancer medication recycling. This kind of speaks for itself. This will allow voluntary pilot programs to occur to see if we can recapture some unused cancer medications and cut costs in the system. Next slide. SB 409, pharmacy practice testing, codifies an executive order waiving certain license testing restrictions to permit pharmacists to order SARS-CoV tests and collect specimens necessary. This is a very technical bill. Let's skip to the next section, which is public health. And just very quickly, AB 439 adds non-binary gender identity option for death certificates. And then the next act, SB 336, public health requires additional guidance on orders. What it does is it increases transparency at the local level for local health departments to disseminate information about pandemic level threats to the public. Let's go to the next section, licensure and scope. I think we can hit these very quickly. Basically, there's a series of bills here that are expanding the ability of licensed healthcare providers to provide services during pandemic level events. This one is loosening the restrictions around getting physicians to come into the state. Let's go to the next slide. This allows optometrists to do COVID vaccinations. Next slide. There's a couple of bills that impact pharmacists and allow them to administer both COVID and pediatric level vaccinations a little bit more easily with a little bit more flexibility. Go to the next slide. And then finally, AB 1184, confidentiality of medical information. This augments the existing law requiring health plans and insurers to notify subscribers and enrollees about submission of confidential communication requests. So best example would be spouse of an insured under an employer-sponsored health plan or policy who's seeking care or information relative to substance abuse disorder or even intimate partner violence activities. Okay, next slide. All right. And this is our legislative focus for next year. Trina, you want to kick this off?
Sure. So 2022 is going to be fun. It's an election year, which means we probably expect lots of activity, both at the executive and legislative level. As we noted earlier in the presentation, there will be continued focus on reducing healthcare costs and whether that's through AB 1130 and other activities. We will continue to see activities around that particular issue around reducing healthcare costs and alternatively healthcare affordability legislation. The last two things, CalAIM, it's coming. So January 1st, there's a whole set of issues that are going, a whole set of initiatives that become live from changing the organ transplant coverage and benefits to the continuation, to the start of the enhanced case management and in lieu of services benefits and other things that will be in play moving forward through CalAIM. And last thing, as we mentioned again earlier, as part of our budget oversight overview, was the health information exchange. There are quite a few things that are due from the executive branch to the legislature in 2022, and a lot of things outlined in legislation in the statute that the state will be required to deliver in 2022. And so there'll be continued focus on some of those activities. Invite Bill or and Nick to add other color commentary.
Nick, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, there's a two-year single-payer bill that's hanging out there that is either going to be a real problem or a real distraction, and neither of those are good outcomes. So it's going to have to be dealt with one way or the other in January. Mm-hmm. And so we know the Nurses Association and the advocates on that side are going to be pretty active and pushing it hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that the single payer bill is going to be heard in the legislature, and so it's going to consume time. And 2022 is the last run-up year for the implementation of the new healthcare payments database, which goes live on January 1, 2023. And so as we get closer to that implementation date, we may even see some legislation or budget trailer bill language to try to close gaps in the data collection issues around that. So we're going to see more data stuff, like always. I think we can turn it over to Q&A now.
Okay, very good. We've got a few questions in here and I'm going to jump right into them very quickly so that we can answer as many of them as possible. This one is from Mary Curry of Torrance Memorial IPA. SB 242 is for pandemics, but states it is for costs after January 2022. There will continue to be expenses. Will this apply or is this purely for a future pandemic?
Purely for future pandemics. And they have to be respiratory-based pandemics.
Yeah.
Okay. This next one is from Jennifer Jackman from America's Physician Groups. And this question is for Nick. Why are your plans telling delegated groups that it is their responsibility to pay these bills if, as you say, they are not medically necessary? Plans are the interpreter of benefits, not groups.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, since I think some of these issues are going to be debated and discussed as a part of the legal, I should probably not comment. But, you know, various contracts, you know, I do know that contracts were amended during the pandemic. And so, you know, I'll just kind of leave it at that.
Okay. Going back to Zimmer, go ahead. All good? Okay. Going back to Zachary's question, he put a clarification in the panel here. And for his question, which was, how do you define inconsistent with good professional practice? Zachary says it's from the step therapy bill.
Oh, so AB 347? I think what we would say is... you know, inconsistent with peer-reviewed clinical guidelines and the available research, so evidence-based medicine.
I would agree with that.
Okay. I've got another one from Zachary. This one is, for reuse of cancer meds, isn't it illegal to transfer your prescription to another person? How is this going to be regulated to ensure what is being turned in for reuse is not tampered with?
I don't know. It's a good question. We leave it up to the regulators to figure that one out, and then we'll comment. So thanks for the input.
All right, very good. That is all the questions that we have received. So I'm going to bring Mike back in to take us out.
Well, thank you, Bill, Nick, Trina, for the session today. As always, very informative. We appreciate your attendance and the information today. And on behalf of HICE and our presenters, we want to thank everyone for joining this session and for being a part of our virtual conference again this year. Thanks so much.